voice comes in, you know it is time to begin. And wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to
ELC.
Woo! Especially if you're one of our geeks and sneaks, using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Or hey, maybe like me, you're stuck inside with the rain. Maybe you're watching all those weeds grow in the backyard and going, when am I going to get the time to weed them? Well, fear not. We're going to be in your ear holes for 90 plus minutes of gaming goodness, because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be. And that is completely free. Thanks to our patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. Those fine folks are bringing the show to you. Their generosity, their support means we get to make these. Oh boy, are we grateful. In exchange, our patrons get a whole bunch of bonus content. They get ad-free versions of the show. They get video versions of the show. They get extra shows, including Feeling This, where Christian Spicer and Alex Solomon talk about the feelings behind video games. Seasons of content there waiting for new patrons to experience. Plus, our weekly Wednesday feel-good fun show. We call it Paid DLC. Lana Bashinsky joins us, talking about the all the crazy, wacky stuff that patrons want to talk about. It's good fun. It's available only for patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. But this show, the main show, DLC, it's the show all about games in their many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata, that's spelled with two N's and one T. And I am joined, as always, by my friend slash co-host, slash nemesis, the guy who suffers no rain, Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
No rain, just a season we call fire season. You know, it's just that beautiful time of year when Southern California burns. Or maybe right now you're like me and you're sitting down to work to record a show as your family is all cuddled together on the couch having family movie night as they stay up late into the night as this Memorial Day holiday here in the United States kicks in. And you get to sit up in your office huddled around a computer talking about video games with a guy who insists on calling you his nemesis for 11 years. Maybe that's what you're doing as you're listening to this.
Well, you know, maybe you, sounds like you won. You win. You won that equation.
I won that. Oh, hey. Yeah. Yeah. Take that, family, you loser. How did I win that equation? Okay. It's going to be a good show.
Speaking of winning, Christian Spicer, speaking of winning, hey, we got a big episode for you. We got an awesome episode. We got tons to get to. But we also have something you, the listeners, may be able to win this week. Stay tuned, because we're going to give you all the details later on in the show. One of our sponsors has been sponsoring for a couple months now, MSI. Maker of fine motherboards, is going to be giving away a motherboard, MSI gear, to some folks. And one lucky listener of the podcast is going to win the MSI MPG Z890 Carbon Wi-Fi motherboard. This is a killer motherboard. We're going to give you all the details on how you can be that lucky winner later on in the show. So stick around, listen up for that. It's a big deal. It's pretty cool. MSI wants to give one of our listeners sweet motherboard. But we, hey, like I said, we got an awesome show for you. We got tons of games to get to. And we have an awesome guest to do it with. You know, the DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian. But this week, woo, I'm excited because once again, DLC stands for Digital Livelihoods and Commerce, because we have the co-host of the Virtual Economy Podcast, author of the Game Dev Business and Budgeting Handbooks, producer, director, consultant, our friend Mike Futter joining us once again. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Doing awesome, man. How are you doing?
Great. I am really glad that I was able to fix my computer in time for this.
We are too. You know, you could have used one of those RAM MSI issues. Motherboards.
I know, right?
Awesome. Well, I'm, yeah, the RAM issues are not good. Were you literally like putting your PC back together today?
Today was rebuilding my profile. Yesterday okay. was getting the new RAM in, just pulled all the old sticks. Thankfully RAM's not too bad right now. So I just replaced it all.
Oh, always fun to spend the day inside your case or in this case, doing the software side.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we glad you're here. Always fun to chat with you. Let's jump in, start the show the way we always do, with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happened in the world of games this week. You can always submit stories for our consideration by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. That is our email address. That's where you can send us stories, comments, questions, anything you like. We love hearing from you at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. It's not the only way to reach out. We also have a Discord where fun folks are hanging out, talking about games, all sorts of other cool stuff. That is 5x5DLC on Discord. Check it out. But Mike, you are our guest, so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Well, as we are on the eve of the Switch 2 launching, taking a look at what is going on in the industry in terms of its performance so far in 2025, Circana released its report for April, courtesy of Matt Piscatella, who, if you are not following on Blue Sky and LinkedIn, you absolutely should. Not only is he brilliant, but he's a really nice guy. It's been a rough year so far, and we're not heading in a good direction, but maybe the Switch 2 turns that around.
Yeah, we were supposed to be getting the biggest video game launch of all time this year to turn that around. It turns out that's not happening. So maybe the biggest video game console launch of all time will help.
Maybe. I think that price is going to scare some people off potentially.
Yeah.
It's especially when you look at what the original Switch launched at, $299, and here we are coming in at, you know, $450. It's going to be tough.
So Circana, for folks that may not be aware, let us know what this report is and how it's sourced and what why it matters.
So Circana is the new name for the company that used to be called NPD. And if you have been around the industry, you've probably heard that name. They effectively take a bunch of sales data from across sectors. We just happen to be focused on the video game sector. And they present kind of outlook for a variety of different sectors, food and entertainment and toys and lots of different things. But this is something that I've been covering my entire time in the industry, back when I was a full-time journalist and now as an analyst. And typically it's, you know, the United States is certainly not the only market, but we're one of the largest. So while this isn't fully representative of gamers, players, consumers, you know, across the world, this is a good indication of kind of where the global industry is headed. And April was a tough month. It really was. Total sales were down 3%, which, you know, if someone told me that I was going to have more than $4 billion and that's down 3%, I think I'd be okay. I think I would console myself, you know, jumping into Uncle Scrooge's money bin or, you know, good stuff. But for the year so far, we're down 8%.
Okay.
And, you know, last year was tough. We ended last year about even. I think we ended 2024 up 1%. So we're down 8% right now. Content, so that's, you know, physical and digital games, that's DLC, that's, you know, recurrent revenue. So if you're buying V-Bucks, for instance, this would fall in there. Down 2% for the month and 6% for the year.
So people are spending less in every facet of video games.
Indeed, at least here in the United States. Okay. And that includes mobile, by the way, because they're partnered up with Sensor Tower, which is effectively doing what Circana does for the broader sector PC console, but they do it for mobile. So they've teamed up to kind of prepare a larger report. Hardware was down 8% for the month. Now that's not a huge surprise, but it's down 28% for the year. And it was down pretty significantly last year also. Hmm. And part of that's because we haven't seen the mid-gen refreshes like we have for the last two cycles. Sure, we have the PlayStation 5 Pro, but at that price point, it's not really for everybody, unlike the PS4 Pro, which was kind of more mainstream. And accessories.
One suspects, though, that, you know, Switch 2 coming along, you know, in mere days is going to make up for that, no?
I think it will. I think it's going to start recovering. Will it make up 28%? that's going to be tough. And mm-hmm. I think that's because of supply constraint. No matter how much Nintendo said going into this that, you know, they were prepared, that they were going to meet demand, and maybe they will in other parts of the world because obviously tariffs are creating some challenges.
Yeah.
As I'm sure you've talked about and as the entire industry is talking about. Yep. But 28%, that's going to be tough for the Switch 2 alone to make up. And then accessories were down 2% for the month and down 13% for the year. So we are down across the board.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Switch 2 is kind of the one big bright spot. I think it's going to help not only with hardware, I think it's going to help with software. Typically when new consoles come out, people are very eager to buy a lot of new games.
Yeah.
Mario Kart's going to do really well.
Yeah.
The question is, will it come in at number one on the Circana report for June? I don't know, because Nintendo doesn't report digital sales. They only report physical sales. So some companies allow Circana to report out everything, and some only, you know, allow them to report physical sales, which they get from retailers. So Nintendo and Xbox don't.
Does the alternate SKU of the Switch 2 itself count toward the, you know, Mario Kart sales?
If Circana is able to discern how many of each unit were sold, we'll probably get some kind of clarity for that, you know, around that, but it's probably going to be pretty fuzzy.
Interesting. Interesting. Any bright spots here? I mean, it sounds pretty, pretty.
Absolutely. So here's one of the weird ones. Xbox Series consoles were up last month while PlayStation and Switch were down. I can't think of any specific reason that Xbox was up other than Oblivion Remastered, which released across three platforms, PC, Xbox, and PlayStation.
Well, Oblivion being a huge hit, but also another in a long line of Game Pass, you know, notable Game Pass releases. Maybe, you know, the Game Pass box is, you know, we're getting a little momentum from just being a Game Pass box.
Yeah, absolutely. But Oblivion Remastered was remarkable. It was the number one game across PC, PlayStation, and Xbox for the month.
Wow.
And it was a shadow drop. You never see shadow drops do that.
It's crazy how much pent-up demand there seems to have been. It just felt – it was a surprise to me. I mean, I knew people obviously have a lot of affection for Elder Scrolls, and it's been so long since there's been a mainline Elder Scrolls release. I mean, we keep getting new versions of Skyrim for a decade. But – I really did not realize how much this game was going to be taken up by so many folks. I it's pretty cool to see a remaster like this sort of take the market by storm in the way that Oblivion has.
Yeah, and when you look at what it did in April of this year versus when it came out in March 2006, you actually get a real good sense of how much the industry has grown and how much the audience has grown in about 20 years. Hmm. So yeah, we're talking 19 years ago. So a couple stats that I really love from this report. So it sold more in April unit-wise than the first 15 months of the original release.
Wow. 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 That's wild. And that game was a hit.
It was. It was huge.
Yeah.
And then in terms of dollar sales, it made up the first 14 months of the original release.
Wow.
So, I mean, that is the bright spot to me as we look at how big this industry has grown, how many people there are playing around the world. That's the bright spot for me because it says to me that gaming is here to stay. It shouldn't be a surprise to anybody who listens to this show, but gaming is here to stay. And we are going through a rough patch right now. What recovery ultimately looks like and what this industry looks like when things start to turn around, there's still a lot of fuzziness around that. There's a lot of questions. Yeah. But will the industry recover? Will we still be here, you know, in a couple years, 5 years, 10 years? Yeah, I don't think we're going anywhere. What it means, what this industry kind of, what the norm is going to change. But in some way, shape, or form, gaming's not going anywhere.
It's great to hear. And I love the analysis and backing it up with hard data. I'm so curious your perspective as an analyst and a consultant looking at this stuff. How you interpret the Grand Theft Auto 6 delay and how that affects the latter half of 2025?
I think that in terms of the industry as a whole, I think we are going to be lower than anybody expected because we were anticipating this game launching in the bottom half of the year. It was going to lift everything up. It was going to motivate console sales. We don't know if it's going to be launching on PC or not when it finally comes out. Chances are no, based on history. So it's probably going to motivate not only, you know, new players coming into the generation, so PS5 and Xbox Series S, which it'll be interesting to see how it runs on the Series S, but the Series X definitely. And then I think it's going to motivate a lot of PS5 Pro purchases. I think people are going to look at that price tag and say, I really love Grand Theft Auto. I've been waiting for this game for, you know, by this point, 13 years when it comes out. You know, I want to play it in the best way that I possibly can when it comes out. That's going to be the PS5 Pro. So I do think we're going to see an uptick in PS5 Pro adoption.
I wonder if there will be a skew built around that in and of itself. There'll be a themed PS5 Pro skew that Sony announces early part of next year. They'll try to capitalize on that. It seems like a no-brainer, but I don't know if Rockstar will play ball.
I don't know. I think the challenge is that if one of the things that's been so unprecedented about this generation is typically, you know, you look at a decay curve and you look at pricing matching that. Right. You see prices come down. That gives the room for those new SKUs, which is why the PS5 Pro is so expensive, because there hasn't been the prices coming down, but prices have been going up. We've never seen anything like that before. Yeah. And it started with the Oculus Quest 2 when Meta announced that the price was going to go up on that. And then, of course, we've seen PlayStation increase prices a couple of times. And, you know, there are analysts out there who are saying, if you want to switch to, go get one at launch, because chances are prices are going to go up.
That's the cheapest it's going to be as at launch.
Right.
Crazy.
Which is, you know, for us old guys, that's weird.
Yeah.
That's so weird.
Yeah. Yes. It's an anathema to how it's supposed to work. But, you know, here we are in uncharted territory.
Yeah. So to your point about Grand Theft Auto and bundling, you know, typically, if you remember back in the Xbox 360 days, I used to go, Microsoft had a loft in New York. I used to go up there they used to do executive tour, tours around the country and stuff. But there was one year we went the holidays and they had 20 different bundles of Xbox 360s. Bundling is a way to keep your price point the same, but still offer more value around key points like the holidays to consumers. They're just not doing it anymore. Not in big numbers. So the fact that the Switch 2 is launching with the Mario Kart World one also to me says, get in on this now if you want one.
Interesting. Wow, that's great to know. Christian Spicer, what do you make of all this? The Oblivion remaster, did you see this one coming? This massive sales hit that this game, this, you know, ancient game has turned into?
It's become bigger over time, right? Which I think is a testament to not only, as Mike mentioned, more people playing, but the type of experiences people have gravitated toward playing. It is, and we've talked about it on the show, I think as a game, it is very rough around the edges, even with this new coat of paint on it. But it very much fits the mold of so many of the games that people are really into these days in terms of letting you find your own path, letting you poke around, letting you have fun, emergent gameplay that works well for folks streaming or folks looking to create clips to share on TikTok, you know, for Filmcast, Jeff, and movies and stuff like that, where you all talk about box office and box office predictions. One thing that changed faster in the film industry and is just starting to catch up in stuff like this report in video games is the social activation reach of things. And I know game companies are tracking that and they're on top of that. But when you read a Deadline article now about a movie, it'll talk about its box office and then it'll talk about Tom Cruise's social reach because he activated his fans for XYZ. And I think for games right now, because you don't have a Tom Cruise necessarily out there, you know, leading the charge, or even Charlie Cox.
I mean, except for on this show where we have two Tom Cruises.
Yes, it's hard to pick which.
I mean,
of
in this episode,
three, of us,
three Tom Cruises.
I was not going to say which one of us wasn't. One of us is John Krasinski, and the other two are Tom Cruises. You know, it's like I'm trying. I mean, I'm not going to say which one of us, me, but one of us is trying to live up to those expectations. But with video games now, I think a lot of that social activation is still largely organic or creator based versus creator of the game based. You know, they reach out to these streamers and these content creators and the folks that are able to make compelling content out of the game. And these Bethesda games have always been great at that. You know, so much of that. Yeah. And I think
That, I think the mod scene with those games also contributes to that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which so this one still supports. Yeah.
That audience has grown since, you know, 19 years ago when that first game came out. So I think that's a big part of why it likely caught on with folks. I think to the Xbox Series seeing an uptick, I don't know if this accounts for all of it, but Microsoft announced their price increase. But then a lot of retailers still had stock at the old price. So again, it was, as Mike mentioned, analysts are saying, now buy the Switch 2 now because it's cheap as it's ever going to be. It was kind of like, hey, if you're on the fence about an Xbox, Walmart still has it at old MSRP. So if you were on the fence, you probably bought it then instead of waiting until Summer Games Fest or Christmas or something like that when it's going to be more expensive and older.
Price increases. Whew.
It's wild. And then the last thing that I think is maybe, I don't know how telling this is, and it's not necessarily new. You know, Blizzard hit on it when they announced Diablo Immortal and everybody having a phone. But the quaintest, I guess, anecdote I heard about all of this and the Switch 2 coming out and PS5 Pro adoption was just from parents talking about none of their kids are asking for a console when they already have a device that plays all the games they want or all the games they have time for. And with a story that I'll be bringing up here in a minute, we'll talk more about it. One of those big games is back on those devices. And so I don't know to what extent, I agree with Mike, gaming's not going away. It's as healthy as it ever was. But I think part of that downtick is also just the continued phonification of gaming and what it means to kids coming up right now where they get a phone easier from parents than they do a console because, oh, we need this to keep in touch. I need this to know when hockey's over. I need this to know when you're done with soccer. I need this to know where you're going to be. And they're like, great, mom and dad. Also, I'm playing COD all day, you know, and a console is like, I don't know, Timmy, that's expensive. Maybe for your birthday. And Timmy, meanwhile, already has a console that can do ray tracing in their pocket. So I think all of that. And then my last point, I'm sorry, I've been rambling, is ups and downs are always really fascinating to track in stock market. I love Marketplace. I love Kai Risdale. I love Marketplace. But you have to remember you're viewing it from a change from yesterday or from last week. So all this stuff is down. But if you zoom back, I think as Mike hinted at with Bethesda and Oblivion, it's up. Everything is still up. And so if you get like COVID, we're still kind of coming down from, but the large trend of players and spending and money being put into gaming from not five years, that was COVID boom. But before that, the 15 years before that, everything is still trending up. And I think we're still course correcting post COVID, to put it succinctly.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I thought it was cool that you brought up a comparison between, you know, movies and the video game industry, just because it occurred to me as you were speaking that I think the big surprise hit of this early summer period so far is the new Final Destination movie, Bloodlines, which I'm tempted to draw parallels to Oblivion, because I think in both cases you can look at an entire generation of people that sort of, you know, in the video game case grew up with Skyrim, right? Have fond memories of Skyrim a decade ago and feel like, oh, there's this sort of undiscovered thing that I now has been brought into the modern era and has just been released, and I can sort of relive the nostalgia but also get this kind of fresh experience. And I think that's similar to what's happening with the Final Destination hit, where there's this kind of mix of nostalgia and a whole generation that hasn't had this IP for a long time and remembers it from when they were young. And
so, and is huge on social before then. It was a meme and a thing, like the truck with lumber on it was a TikTok thing long before Bloodlines was ever, you know, an idea to be another Final Destination movie. And so now you're seeing those things come full circle at just the right time, and it's lightning in a bottle, it feels like.
Yeah. It's worrisome only in the sense that, you know, I think it leads to more mining of the past rather than forging ahead. But, you know, we've been in that cycle for a while now, so there's nothing new there. But, you know, fascinating stuff. And I think it's cool that people are loving Oblivion so much and that it has caught on in this new way. I mean, it's a game I certainly love very much. So really cool. Thanks for bringing the data, Mike. It's awesome to see this all laid out like that. And I'm so curious, you know, we have these two big blips that have been we've been looking at, been waiting for literal years in, you know, GTA 6 and the Switch 2. And we thought they were going to kind of come bang, bang, right one on top of the other almost. And now they're being spread out a bit and everybody is scrambling. And I just think it's so interesting to see how that's going to shape the end of the rest of the year software wise, what other publishers are going to do, or people are going to try to get games out and, you know, push before May 26th of next year, and how all that is going to shake out. And if we're going to see another GTA 6 delay, you know?
I can't imagine they will. I mean, they already got smacked around a little bit by investors because they were expecting it in this fiscal year and it got bumped into next fiscal year. I am seeing one interesting thing though, because Microsoft also released Forza Horizon 5 and Indiana Jones and the Great Circle on PlayStation 5.
Right.
And both of them charted really well. Forza Horizon 5 was the number two game of the month, jumping up from 42.
Wild. Wild.
And Indie was number six, up from 118. And then they've got Minecraft. So Microsoft at one and two, and then at four, and then at six, and then at seven with Call of Duty Black Ops 6. And then in there, you've got WWE, NBA, and PGA at 8, 9, and 10. So 2K and Microsoft kind of dominating the charts. Minecraft Minecraft's usually up high, jumped up from 11 to 4. I think that's on the back of the movie.
Right.
Last of Us Part 2 jumped up from 23 to 13. Again, I think that's based on, you know, the show. Can we call it HBO Max yet, even though it hasn't officially been rebranded? rebranded?
Yeah. Max, HBO Max, talk to me in 15 minutes. I got to figure it out. Yeah.
Elder Scrolls Online jumped up too. And I think that's on the back of Oblivion, because people are just like, oh, I finished Oblivion. Let's try this Elder Scrolls Online thing.
Right, right.
And then Elden Ring come end of this month, beginning of next month, I think is going to be huge because of Nightreign.
Yeah. It's crazy that Microsoft is, you know, this thing that everybody tried to tell them was a bad idea. It's been a massive success. Mm-hmm. Hey, put your games out on more consoles. Okay, let's dominate the sales charts.
Yep.
Pretty wild. Pretty wild. Awesome stuff. All right. Let's take a little break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more Stories of the Week right after this. This episode of DLC is brought to you by Green Chef. Hey, as we step into spring, it's beautiful. The sun is shining. The flowers are flowering. You could even say blooming. And it's the perfect time to refresh your meal routine with dietitian-approved recipes from Green Chef. Perfect for supporting your wellness journey. You enjoy recipes that feature fresh, organic, seasonal produce and 100% responsibly sourced proteins crafted to help you feel your best. Christian, the thing I like most about Green Chef is that it makes things easy for me. I like products that make my life easier, but also healthier. And it's easy with Green Chef to spend less time in the kitchen and enjoy more time in that beautiful spring sunshine,
where you can see the flowers flowering. Green Chef lets you be chefing. You know, like,
that's right.
You could also say cooking, but it lets you be chefing. Man, we had maple carrot power bowls. My
maple carrot power bowl.
Dude, so good. It's a couscous. There's like cranberries and kale. That's unbelievable.
By the way, that's my favorite NCAA tournament, the maple carrot power bowl.
You haven't achieved anything as a college athlete until you made it to the maple carrot power bowls, which would be an incredible athlete's table meal to have, because you'd be powered up and ready to go.
Yeah. The Green Chef now has also heat and eat meals, where you can enjoy a delicious, wholesome meal in just 3 minutes. Plus, with over 80 weekly options, Green Chef makes it easy to find meals that fit your lifestyle, whether you're into Mediterranean flavors, gluten-free eats, plant-based meals, or protein-packed dishes. There's something for everyone, including options for gut and brain health, calorie-smart choices, and more. I know, Christian, as a vegetarian, you often have a hard time finding delicious stuff, but man, Green Chef is the place for any type of diet, whether it's a salad ready in just 5 minutes, protein-packed breakfasts, a smoothie to fuel your day. Green Chef has you covered for the busiest days. Their meals are made with real, clean ingredients, so you can build lasting healthy habits without the hassle. Plus, you got that flexibility week to week. This is one of the things I love most too, is that you can adjust your plan anytime to fit your schedule, skip a week, whatever you need, change the delivery day. It's great. Make this spring your most delicious yet with Green Chef. Head to greenchef.com/50DLC. That's 50DLC. Use code 50DLC to get 50% off your first month, then 20% off for 2 months with free shipping. That's code 50DLC at greenchef.com/50DLC. All right, Christian Spicer, what is your story of the week?
I hinted at it before, and we'll just get right into it. Fortnite is back on the iOS store in America. It's on the Epic store and Alt store in Europe as well. Epic fought their way in, you know, millions of dollars of legal fees and everything else. And we talked about the lawsuit and its current status, or then current status, a couple of weeks ago, Jeff. And then in between then and now, it came back and it was first back, and Epic was trying to get it back through their European account, I think, because their American account was still banned. Apple was like, no, we're not going to let you do that. They ran to court. Apple let them. Court said you had to. All of the things, you know, happened at the exact same time. So it came back, but also wasn't discoverable. I don't know how long that lasted, maybe 12 hours. It was on the iOS store, and Apple really seemed to be like dragging their feet. If you searched for it, you couldn't find it. It was there. You had to know like the hex code, you know, to get it. You had to National Treasure your way into downloading Fortnite on iOS. But now it is there. It is searchable. It's, you know, just back. And by all accounts, is massive again. I mean, absolutely massive again. I believe it's still charting number one on the iOS store. The amount of folks playing and talking about diving back on iOS. And awesomely, oddly enough, the number of folks I've seen talking about this being their first experience playing on iOS and the excitement to see all their skins and all their characters. It was this weird timing of things for how long Fortnite was gone from iOS, and now new people coming into the game, and this is kind of their first cross save. Epic, you know, carries it everywhere, because those folks were just playing just on Switch or just on Xbox or just on PlayStation. They were just one device players. Meanwhile, Android players were like, hi, we've been doing this for a while. But seeing people's excitement to see all of their Mandalorian skins on iOS as they're diving back into it for the Star Wars season and stuff like that. I mean, this game is still a juggernaut and back on iOS now. I think this is huge news, not only for what it might mean for, you know, future console sales, but what it means for iOS gaming in the US and what it means for the App Store going forward for Apple as well. This is massive.
Yeah. You know, this protracted legal drama that we have followed, its ups and downs over many months now on the show, checking in as the developments have come across. I was never really sure we were going to get to this point where it was actually going to be on iOS. And here we are. It's pretty wild. And it doesn't seem like Apple's too happy about it, because they're not getting any of that sweet, sweet money anymore, or, you know, at least not the percentage they wanted. Mike, what do you make of this? I mean, this is a pretty big deal, right?
Yeah, it's huge. And I think the big takeaway here is don't piss off Judge Yvonne Gonzalez Rogers, like, ever. Right. I would not want to be late for dinner at her house. Let's just put it that way. Like, she was so mad at Apple.
Yeah.
The first time was bad
rightfully,
enough.
Rightfully so.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. She's like, I issued an order. You defied it. You knew what you were doing. Knock it off.
Yeah.
And then when they rejected the Fortnite application, where she's like, either you fix this or the person who's responsible for making this decision is in my courtroom on Tuesday. And I have a funny feeling there was going to be a contempt charge. Because she's been over this. She was over it before before the original trial ended.
Yeah.
But she is really over it now.
It's wild what happens.
Can we get her assigned to some of these other cases that might be useful for the United States?
It was her from the top rope. It was, I read that order. I read, and it was just, that was scathing.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it was it did feel very not just, hey, I'm making a ruling here. I'm making a point. And yeah, and the result is, you know, Apple loses, and this is big. And seeing Fortnite back in the App Store, pretty wild. I'm not a huge Fortnite player myself, but I recognize how big of a deal this is. And yeah, Christian, you're right to bring it up as a big story of the week. I mean, this has been a long story. This is just the end tale. I'm curious if either of you think there are more chapters to be written here, or if this kind of puts this to bed.
I think there are more chapters to be written. I think they're going to continue to fight for full-on alternate stores until we see the Epic Game Store on iOS as a store you can load the way you can in the EU. But I don't even think they're done fighting in the EU with how open they want it to be. This isn't a direct, and people have emailed me already about some of my not exactly one-to-one comparison. So I need to say on the outset, this is not a one-to-one comparison, but there was a time when Windows computers came bundled with so much Microsoft stuff that was so difficult to get rid of. And yes, you could use another word processor, but we're going to intentionally brick half of your computer if you do it. And I'm very curious how long and how long Apple will drag their feet on this versus your iOS device becoming more like a modern PC. Or I guess even before Windows was doing it, IBM, right? You had IBM clones because IBM had the lockdown on what a personal computer was or would be back then. So I do not think this is the end. I'm very curious to see if Xbox has their full-on store on iOS and when and what that means. And I think we're going to see ripple effects of this on Android, even though it is far more open. And I've had a Pixel 2 for forever since it had an OLED screen in it as kind of my Android-based gaming phone. But I think we're going to see more complete alternate stores, if that makes sense, or stores you would tell your parents to use on Android, if that makes sense. Like, everybody just knows the Google Play Store.
V-Bucks.
To spend all their bucks. To spend all their bucks, my friend. All their bucks. But I think it's huge. I think it's going to continue to be huge. And I think it will continue to impact gaming in ways that we don't necessarily see on the forefront, but that might be bigger than any other story any given week.
Yeah. I think Xbox Cloud Gaming on iOS is almost assured. You may recall that the reason why we didn't really have that, they had their web-based application versus something, you know, official in the App Store, was because Apple was requiring them to submit every single game on Game Pass as a separate application, which is not how it works. So Microsoft said, screw it, we'll just do, you know, a web-based app that you can save to your home screen and pretty much work around the App Store entirely.
Yeah.
I think it's going to improve at this point moving forward.
Very cool stuff. And we will keep talking about it as it develops. But you can play your Fortnite on your iPad and your iPhones. So get at it, folks. All right. My story of the week. I'm tempted. My heart wants me to pick the 6-1 Indie Showcase because they showed 48 indie games. 48 indie games, ladies and gentlemen. That is technically... And it's hard for me to not pick that because I love indie games. But you know what? Most of my playlist is going to be demos from that. So I kind of will be able to get my cake and eat it too. So I'm going to actually have my story of the week be this other very interesting bit of news about Switch 2. Again, we're coming up on release, so all the information will be known. But I think this bears discussion. There was a demo this week online, I think it was on Twitch, where a representative from Koei Tecmo was playing Nobuganda's Ambition Awakening CE running on Switch 2. And about 10 minutes into the gameplay demo, the game's producer pulled out a USB mouse, plugged it into the Switch 2, and started playing their game with any old USB mouse. and mentioned it and said, hey, once you connect the USB mouse, a message will appear in the top left indicating the mouse is connected. And when the USB mouse is connected, it takes priority over the Joy-Con 2. So we have known that the, you know, the cool whiz-bang feature of the Joy-Cons is that you turn them on their end and they can work like a mouse. I guess we can also use any mouse we want. This has not been confirmed for every game. We don't know if it's a game by game. We don't really know how many or how widespread or if there's mice that don't work this way. But the idea, extrapolating that any game that allows you to use a Joy-Con 2 as a mouse could also let you just use a mouse, I think that's kind of a big deal. And I'm curious if you agree, Mike.
Oh, I totally agree. I'm just wondering if 10 minutes after that live stream ended, if Nintendo wasn't ringing the phone being like, girl, come on.
Excuse me. We did not discuss this. Wild. Well, it seems to be a seamless and very easy process. It seems to be something the Switch 2 welcomes you to do and it wants to make easy and seamless for you to do. That sounds great to me. I'm into this. Part of my worry, having not touched a Switch 2 yet myself, was that the Joy-Con 2 mouse mode was not going to feel great. And I know I've heard from a number of people who have touched it who said it actually does feel pretty good. But knowing that as a left-handed guy, I can maybe plug in any old left-handed mouse or ambidextrous mouse I want, that makes me pretty happy and makes me feel like I will use this feature more than I was going to already. Christian, what do you think?
I think this is great for folks who play here at their desk, right? And I think Metroid Prime 4 at a desk with an actual mouse over a Joy-Con mouse, or games that, or Civ 7 maybe is a better example, because I could see in Metroid Prime 4 maybe still using some of the motion control within the Joy-Con as the mouse, like they showed in the wheelchair basketball game where it's a mouse, but also you're doing more than just mouse stuff. So I could see a traditional mouse maybe being limiting in some respects. But for the whole way that the Switch 2 reveal has happened, gentlemen, this feels like the most on-brand version of finding out that a mouse works, you know?
yeah.
Which is perfect.
Yeah. Nintendo's not mentioning it. It's just happening. And some guys, you know, demoing a completely different game and, you know, their own game, just saying, this works, by the way, BT dubs. Yeah. Very, very on-brand. You're right with how this is all unfolded. And it begs the question, like, USB anything else? USB
keyboards? Thinking that. And then all of a sudden, RTS on consoles is a real proposition again.
Yeah. Yes. Or, I don't know. WoW? You know, why not, right? Why not have a portable WoW machine or any other MMO or anything? I mean, I think this is something that people have been wanting. You know, we had a very intense period of people wanting to be able to play mouse-based games on their consoles. And then that sort of waned, you know, that sort of it's kind of went away and people haven't really been clamoring for that. And Nintendo might single-handedly bring that concept back. Mm-hmm. And I think that could be a really compelling use case for this thing, like a portable, I mean, obviously we have laptops, we have whatever, but I think that might be really cool. And as Christian, as you pointed out, having these first party Nintendo games like Metroid Prime 4, that might be really cool to play with a mouse. And maybe I don't want to use the Joy-Con that way. Maybe I want my own particular cool thing that feels good in my particular hand. I'm all for it.
Yeah. I think the hard part about the WoW, it kind of goes back to what I think the Wii U's problem was. It still has to work without all of that stuff hooked up, right? It still has to feel okay for someone to play in handheld mode without all of that stuff. Unless, I mean, maybe Nintendo's okay with this. I doubt it. Unless they're okay further cluttering their box art with like requires USB keyboard, requires USB. And you just see a tiny picture of WoW, you know, it's all that's left from all the warnings.
Yeah.
But I think,
I think that's a stretch to think that could happen, but you know, hey,
Final Seems Fantasy like, 14, though, which is designed to work with controllers, but some people might want to play on the go with a mouse and keyboard.
Or, I mean, take away any specific game. They right. literally have an entire chat service as yeah. their key feature of this new console. Mm-hmm. You know, keyboard chat doesn't seem like a bad thing to incorporate. So I don't know. I thought that was a pretty big deal, and I'm glad you guys agree. It's shocking how we found out, and it'll be interesting to see as people kind of throw more USB devices at this thing, how it responds when it's finally out in the wild, which is not too long from now.
Yeah.
All right. Let's take another quick break for a sponsor. We'll be back with our playlist, and we got lots to talk about there. So stick with us. We'll be right back right after this. This episode of DLC is brought to you by MSI. And Christian, we talked about this at the top of the show. This is a pretty big deal. MSI is giving away MSI gear and an MSI MPG Z890 Carbon Wi-Fi motherboard. They're going to give one away to a listener of our podcast based on what they're calling the MSI build of the show.
Jeff, I listened to this podcast. I don't know if you know that. I'm not only.
There's no proof that you have ever listened to anything I say.
Look, there's two things I know. One, I also listen to this show. And two, there's no rule that says a dog can't win a motherboard.
Ruh-roh. So here's what they are asking for. They want you, listener, listening right now, to submit your build, your custom gaming PC build through the MSI Discord server. That's discord.gg/MSI. The link will be in the show notes, but it's discord.gg/MSI. You scroll down to the podcast-channel. That's hashtag podcast-channel. And you submit a photo or video of your system. Write your Discord username along with the podcast you heard this from. That's DLC. That's this podcast, because there's multiple podcasts doing this, but they're giving away one per podcast. So go to their podcast channel. That's hashtag podcast-channel. Write down DLC. Write down your name. This has to be handwritten, a handwritten note. So you write it on a piece of paper. You write your name, like Christian's dog, and then DLC podcast on a piece of paper, analog style. Take a photo of that with your rig. So the picture of the handwritten note is in your photo of your or video of your rig. And you submit that on the Discord no later than 1 month from when this episode airs. So that would be what? June 26th. So the submission deadline is June 26th. US-based listeners only. So sorry, international listeners. This is only open to US-based DLC listeners. And you got to have an MSI component. Okay. Mm-hmm. So use, if you have any MSI motherboard, GPU, power supply, cooling system, chassis, peripheral, monitor, anything MSI makes in your system, take a picture of it, make it look awesome, write your name, handwritten, DLC on that, and submit it to the MSI Discord and podcast channel, and you could win a motherboard. And they're giving away other MSI gear as well.
And also not just a motherboard.
Yeah, right. It's so true.
It's not just a motherboard. It's like a very nice motherboard.
It is incredible. The MPG Z890 Carbon Wi-Fi motherboard. This is built for gamers. This is the motherboard we've been talking about on the show for a long time now. MSI has been gleefully showing off the ability for DIY. This is why they're doing this segment, this build of the show segment. Build it yourself. Christian and I are both huge proponents of building your own rig. We love building PCs. We love getting our hands dirty. And you know what? With these MSI motherboards, you don't even really get your hands dirty. There's
just one hand. One hand dirty. One hand, one not finger. Even dirty. Just boop.
Yeah. Boop. they make it so easy for you to do it yourself. The pride of building your own rig is so awesome. You save a ton of money that way. And especially if, you know, you win your Z890 carbon.
Look, dogs use computers too, okay? You should see my dog's build. You know, it's pretty good, but it could be better with a better motherboard. So I'm
That's right. Christian's dog gets sick FPS. You know what I'm saying? Sick. It's her disgusting.
GPU.
He will own you in any first-person shooter.
It's a first-person shooter.
Ah, that's right. Amazing. So get in on this, man. I think, honestly, I think your odds of winning are going to be really high if you have an MSI component in your build. If you have a build that you can add an MSI component to, do that. Write your name on the on the piece of paper, handwritten, has to be handwritten, with DLC on it. Take a photo or a video of it, upload it to their Discord, and win yourself some sweet MSI gear. They're giving away a swag along with that MPG Z890 carbon Wi-Fi motherboard. So cool. Discord.gg/MSI. Don't forget the handwritten note. Has to be handwritten.
Not paw written. Oh no.
they're two steps ahead of you, Christian.
Oh, my dog has everything but no hands.
Just
a
like your dog,
build.
Always two steps ahead. Thanks to MSI for including DLC in the MSI build of the show. We are so excited to see all the cool entrants at discord.gg/MSI. All right, let's get into it and talk about the games we've been playing in a segment we call The Playlist. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on The Playlist. Mike, you've been playing a lot of stuff. Where would you like to start?
Blueprints.
Okay.
Love Blueprints.
Yes.
And I'm not playing it consistently. It's one of those things, because it is a roguelike. It's still a roguelike. Dive in, do a couple of runs, go back to playing something else. It's just great. I love the puzzles. I love, you know, how many layers it has. It's one of those games that I can unequivocally recommend to most people who play games.
Yeah.
Because you're probably going to find something in there to like.
I think it's remarkable that it is such a dense puzzle game. And we've seen examples of those in the past. Obra Dinn comes to mind, others. I think, as you point out, this is the most accessible of them. And I think a lot of that has to do with, well, first, it gives you something to do that isn't solving puzzles per se, right? You're kind of just working on this little board game mechanic that kind of works in and of itself and is inherently fun just without the additional layers of meta puzzle solving. But also, I think it's a testament to its inherent pacing, if you can call it that. The way that it reveals itself over time and kind of unfolds the layers of puzzles. It doesn't, you know, Obra Dinn, as my example of choice here, is so powerfully dense right from the start, you know? And most games of this ilk are, you know, I think, you know, maybe The Witness is another example of something, or even, you know, a mainstream hit back in the day like Myst, where you can sort of like it eases you into the complexity in, I think, a really smart and effective way.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as someone who is a big board gamer, like, you immediately see shades of Betrayal at House on the Hill with the tile placement. There's an interesting narrative there too. Now you can ignore it pretty much completely. If that's not your thing, if you just like puzzles, great. You don't have to pay attention to the narrative. But if you are someone who likes some story with your puzzles, there's a cool story here.
Yeah. It's an amazing game. And I marvel at its complexity. And I can't believe that it has become such a sort of hit, you know, sort of, there's so much discussion about it. It feels like such a niche game that has transcended that niche. And I think that's great. Great to see. So that's Blueprints. What else is on your playlist?
Couple little ones. I started playing, finally, Power Rangers Rita's Rewind, because we have guests, and one of our young guests is a Power Rangers fan. So I'm like, well, you just convinced me to spend money I was eventually going to spend anyway. So let's go play some Power Rangers.
Is Power Rangers really still good. Big among the young kids? My kids aren't into Power Rangers. I feel like it's a nostalgia brand now, but maybe I'm wrong.
I think that, you know, there's this gap right now. I don't think there's a new series that's out because they're still converting over from Saban to Hasbro. And there's that whole thing going on. But for me, it was a nostalgia thing. Like,
yeah.
I was in high school when Power Rangers was a thing. So, or the original Mighty Morphin Power Rangers.
Oh, man. I a quick little anecdote for me. I was an exchange student in Japan. We had a sister city program in my little hometown in California. And I went over to Japan. And I remember we went to Tokyo Disneyland at the time. And I remember seeing these costume characters. And I thought, man, this looks so goofy. What is this? And they were, you know, everybody loved them. And I had no idea what it was. And I get back to America. And then like 3 months later, they debuted and it was the biggest thing in the world. And I was like, I saw that before it was here. Anyway, stupid story, but
that's a good one. I like that.
Yeah. So how's Rita Rewind?
It's really good. I'm a big fan of that genre, the old school arcade beat 'em up, and it really scratches the itch. We were seeing that genre get a resurgence. So this was a good one.
Big time.
If you have any love of that genre and even a passing interest in Power Rangers, it's an easy one to recommend.
The same folks that made the TMNT game, is that right? The Shredder's Revenge? No.
So Shredder's Revenge was crud. See, now I can't remember. But so this one was Digital Eclipse. Okay. Power Rangers was Digital Eclipse. And then I'm going to type this in, Shredder's Revenge, because I hate. No, that is just Shredder. That's an appliance I can get at Staples.
I put you on the spot. I shouldn't have done it. I should have the information.
No, it was Dot Emu. It was published, okay. And Tribute was the developer on it.
Okay.
But yeah, it's one of a number of really good arcade beat 'em ups. And of course we have the X-Men one that's coming. I think it's the end of this year, which
very
is going to be
really
excited
about cool. That too. Awesome. What else is on your playlist?
I started Clair Obscur Expedition 33. Really love the beginning, and that's about all I've played. And then honestly, I'm biased here because I was the licensing producer on the game, but I've still have been playing our own game, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Tactical Takedown, which was released by Strange Scaffold this week.
Yes, my son really loves that game. He's been super
great.
Into it. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Kudos. Yeah.
Thank you.
So how's it going? How was the release?
A release was great. This was the biggest release that I've been part of, biggest role I've had in a game, for release. And it's been really exciting. Our reviews are coming in strong. So awesome. Can't ask for anything more than that. We have more to do. There's going to be, we've got our 14, 30 and 60 day patches that we're planning. We got some cool stuff in the hopper. Awesome. That should delight fans. And I'm looking forward to talking more about that. But it was a fun game to work on. Really, really wonderful team. And our partners at Paramount were excellent. So
awesome.
It was just a great project all the way around. And we didn't crunch, which was awesome.
Oh, that's great. It seems like a labor of love, a turn-based, TMNT game. It just is not something that, a publisher from the top down is going to say, I want this. It feels like it came from the bottom up. People really wanted to make it themselves.
Yep. And it's, again, it was a lot of fun. And I've spent a lot of time with the game. I've been on the project. I was the third person on the project and worked on
That's
the original
cool.
story concept. And it was. So I've been on this now for 2 years and I'm still like diving in and playing it and having fun with it. So
speaks highly of the game for sure.
Usually I get bored of stuff. I am not bored of our game, but again, I'm super biased.
Well, that's TMNT Tactical Takedown. Available now. Very, very cool. Christian Spicer, what is on your playlist?
Two games that I want to talk about this week. One, the first, I only played the demo of. So as a consumer, I should say I love demos. Love demos. I love demos when your save carries over. love a good demo. As a someone who makes games, I can understand why maybe you might not love demos, because this demo has saved me the $50 or whatever it is from buying the game, because this game did not particularly click with me. It's Blades of Fire. So it's by Mercury Steam. They made Metroid Samus Returns and Metroid Dread, both of which I love. I replay Samus Returns on my actual 3DS hardware probably every couple of years. I really, really like that game. I really love its reimagining of Metroid 2 and Metroid Dread. I have the collector's edition here somewhere. I love that game. I loved Metroid Dread. I loved what it did to evolve and continue that 2D Samus adventure spirit. Mercury Steam also did Castlevania Lords of Shadow. They were co-developers, I think, on that with Konami. I forget if they led it or not, but that lineage. And so I first read a preview about Blades of Fire in Edge magazine a couple of months ago that was pretty high on it, or I guess described a game that seemed like catnip for me. So I was very excited for Blades of Fire to come out. And then I saw they're releasing this demo, which is an awesome demo because it's just the start of the game. It's the first, I've played maybe an hour. I think you could probably get 3 hours out of it if you're really like, you know, picking around the edges, but it's the opening of the game and then your save carries over, which I think is great. So Blades of Fire is much more Castlevania Lords of Shadow than Samus Returns or Metroid Dread. And that is a third person action adventure game that uses some of the learnings from their Metroid development of creating these shortcuts, places you can see that you can't get to yet because you don't have the thing to do the thing, or you haven't found the way to get to the thing. Also with some, the shorthand for it would be Souls Light combat, where it is timing based. You're kind of learning the combat techniques of the enemies you're encountering and have your save, you know, your area where you save and you can rest, and kind of leaning into that style of combat. And then the big thing they're bringing to this genre, I guess, now is this forging mechanic where you are making your weapons. It's a big part of the narrative of this game as well, that you are the last metal forger in existence, or however they frame it, and you have this power, you're able to do it, and you go into this kind of alternate dimension where you have this forge and you have your materials and you can lay them out and you can customize them. You can do some at the beginning, like I'm sure this becomes more in depth as it goes on, but you can do like a axe that has, or is it a hammer? I think it's a sledgehammer. It has like a heavier head that'll do more damage, but it's slower. You can have a longer staff on it or a shorter staff. And so you can kind of customize your things as you go. And then you do the smithing, like you're hammering, and it gives you kind of like a sine wave or, you know, some layout of materials that you have to hit. And as you hit in one part, that part might go down, but then other parts go up. So you're trying to kind of match the weapon you're making to this prescribed dotted line, but it's not an easy just tap here, do it. You have to actually kind of do this little bit of a puzzle mechanic to make the weapon the best it can be. And if you know, five star it or whatever, that's how many times you can rebuild the weapon. They give every weapon you give a name to. It's really meant to have you know, oh, I loved, you know, Andreas, my Andreas hammer, and I had some epic legends, and you're kind of going and building this stuff. And again, describing it now still sounds like catnip for a game that I would love. Unfortunately, just in this demo, I don't think all of those elements coalesced into a cohesive whole. Visually, it looks and feels like what if PlayStation 3 game came out today. Like, I think it's like a almost very intentional art aesthetic of these characters with huge shoulders and big hands and the kind of the way they animate. It doesn't feel cheap, but it feels like maybe hearkening back to that aesthetic. And I don't think it plays particularly well with the kind of Souls Light mechanic or combat they're also trying to layer in. And I just didn't, we should do a whole episode of feeling this if Mr. Alex Summon also plays this game. It's one of those games where it just feels a little bit off in every component, but it's doing a lot of them, just none of them as well as any other game. Again, just from, you know, the first hour I spent on this demo, I came across this large troll as kind of one of the first enemies I think you can stumble upon that's maybe a little out of your league. and I'm able to fight it, but it just became, unlike Elden Ring bosses, where it seems like there's always something new, or even an Elden Ring overpowered enemy, or a Bloodborne overpowered enemy, or any of these games, FromSoft games, it feels more like you're constantly learning as you're going against this troll or ogre or whatever it was. It's like, oh, I've learned its mechanics. Now it's just a spear sponge for the next 10 minutes as I do it. And then I did it, versus that triumphant feeling of picking apart this onion of combat
right,
and whittling my way through it. And then even the forging mechanic, I found it feeling less satisfying and more frustrating that I couldn't get the thing done better. You know, I don't know. When I was playing it, I was trying to think of games where they give you that thing of you have to kind of solve this puzzle, but you mess up more than you succeed, but then you still have the weapon. So now I have a one-star version of this thing when I know a better starred version is possible, but for I smithed it wrong. Instead of filling me with delight, I felt like I should have saved scummed my way to get that weapon. Versus so many other games, I think, handle that better, where you might get I guess Breath of the Wild, right? You might get an awesome weapon and it will break, but it's constantly giving you new things to do stuff with. Versus Blades of Fire, I felt like I was being penalized by not having the best version of the weapon that might be possible. Mm. So it's on console, it's on Epic Game Store, on PC. I think if what I'm saying sounds exciting to you, go download the demo first and see if you love it. Because if you do, it is the first part of the game and your save carries over, which as a consumer is incredible. But unfortunately for me, despite having all the ingredients of games I love, in my first opening with the game, Blades of Fire did not come together to be a game that made me want to spend money going forward.
There you go. That's Blades of Fire. You were playing it on what, PS5? Is that...
I was playing on PC. It's hard to have a beefy GP and not throw anything you can at it. You know what I mean?
What else is on your playlist?
The next thing I want to talk about is something that I love. Oh, I loved it, Jeff. Oh, Mike, I loved it. It is Star Wars Outlaws, A Pirate's Fortune. It's the new story DLC for Star Wars Outlaws, a game that I came to late. I didn't start playing Star Wars Outlaws until it was out on Steam. After all of... These are not the problems you're looking for. All of the problems with the game, in my opinion, were addressed. I love Star Wars Outlaws. I think it's such a wonderful world to be in. I think the way they've realized the Star Wars universe without needing to have you be a Jedi is just exquisite. Everything feels lived in and real, and just spending time in those environments is awesome. And having a story reason to come back and revisit this world again, I was all for it. And Pirate's Fortune is a love letter to Hondo. Like, that's
love him.
That's what it is. Do you love this untrustworthy pirate and you want to spend some time with him? Then you will love A Pirate's Fortune. Narratively, it makes no sense. Like, zero. I mean, just zero. Like, Kay goes on this awesome story. I think her character arc, I think, is really great. I think the end of Star Wars Outlaws is really powerful and speaks to all the things that I think the great Star Wars stories do: trust and teamwork and camaraderie and what is family and discovering yourself and, you know, overachieving, all of those things coming together. And then A Pirate's Fortune requires you to have finished the main campaign, which, sidebar, I always think is fascinating when games do DLC that way, because games know how many people finished the game. Like, you know what the market is for Star Wars Outlaws, and then you're like, now we're going to target 10% of that. 10% of that market. Who's going to come buy this DLC? Anyway, that's for another day. But so this is at the end of Kay's narrative story of Star Wars Outlaws. And then Hondo's like, hey, you've heard my legend. I'm super untrustworthy. And Kay's like, let's do it. You know, it's like, she's learned that lesson. Like, they're not going to, if you throw that away, you don't worry about that. It's super fun. It doesn't overstay its welcome. I think it has incredible set pieces. You get a new ship. There's a moment in the game or not a level, but a part of the plot, I'll be vague, where you are left kind of like Samus, without your stuff. and you need to navigate this enemy base without your things, where you're picking up other things that you can find along the way to make it through. And so it's this really cool cat and mouse of not, it doesn't expect you to be full stealth, not saying like, hey, you have to do this without being spotted. It's saying, how long can you not be spotted before things go to hell? And when they do go to hell, how fast can you find somebody else's blaster? Really, really fun. And I think captures so much of that Star Wars je ne sais quoi of being that Han Solo and firing first and finding a way out of the cantina in a way by the skin of your teeth. Man, I really, really love Star Wars Outlaws. And I think A Pirate's Fortune is just an incredible piece of story content for that game, that if you had finished the main campaign, I cannot recommend A Pirate's Fortune enough, as long as you're willing to forget that Kay had this emotional journey in the main game.
Very cool. That's funny, because maybe if they let you do that before you finished it, she wouldn't have had the emotional journey yet. And
dude, if this was like 3/4 of the way through the main quest, it would make perfect sense.
That's funny. I always love how, you know, we were talking about Oblivion earlier. I always love how Bethesda games do it, where that you get the new DLC and then somebody just runs up to you in the middle of what you're doing, like, hey, do you want to go to this other island where there's other stuff is happening? And you're like, yeah, I do. That sounds awesome. I feel like that's the way to do that stuff.
But it's always fun when you have to Google, how do I start this?
Yeah.
How do I access content just paid money for, please?
Very funny. All right. My story of the – or not story of the week. We're past that. My playlist it relates to the story of the week. Maybe that's why I made the flub. Because I mentioned the 6-1 Indie Showcase, which was really – delightful, I thought. As a big fan of indie games, I absolutely love indie games, and the inventiveness, the risk taking that you see in the indie space is just wonderful. And boy, was it on display in the 6-1 Indie Showcase. I devoured that this week. It was, like I said, 48 games were shown, just a staggering number of. I don't know how any of this is economically viable, frankly, but. Amazing to see the creativity and like I said, the inventiveness of all these wonderful indie games, many of which I was aware of, many more of which were new to me. And the cool thing was they kind of had a takeover of Steam for a while, where a lot of these games were featured and you could wish list them and things like that. And also many of them had demos. So my playlist is just going to be all that I basically played every demo I could of the games that had demos from the 6-1 Indie Showcase. And a few, I thought it was actually very smart the way this was handled. On Steam, they had a bunch of the games, you know, that you could play demos for, a bunch of games that they were showing new trailers for, games that didn't have demos that you could just wish list, or, you know, there was linking to all the activity from these 48 games. But also they had like friends of 6-1 or 6-1 recommends games. So I was ushered into games that had been out in early access or that just had a demo that was released in 2024, but the game still hasn't come out yet. So I played so many really cool, interesting games this week that I hadn't been aware of. And I'm going to pick out some of my favorites. I'm going to start with the easiest one to talk about, which is a game called Cast and Chill. I am not somebody that enjoys fishing in life or in video games. There are folks that dig video game mini games in larger games. There are famous to have, you know, the fishing mini game is a meme in and of itself, right? I don't like fishing in real life. I'm not drawn to it in video games. I find it tedious in both cases. And yet, this game Cast and Chill, which is literally just the fishing mini game, I was drawn to because the level of pixel art on display in this game is truly spectacular. And as the name suggests, it is there to just make you feel good vibes. And so Cast and Chill is literally just a fishing game where you go out on a boat, a little rowboat with your dog. You throw your line into the water. You try to catch fish. You go back and you sell them to a kindly old dude in a baseball cap who works in a fishing shop. You got to get bait. You got to do it. It's none of the stuff I care about. And yet I did appreciate the sort of zen-like, tranquil thing that it's this game is going for. Because even on my, you know, big super ultra-wide monitor that I love, this pixel art fills the entire frame. It is truly gorgeous. I think the goal here is to just elevate pixel art into something that you could just stare at for hours. And it's all animated. You have a number of different stages. The demo only has one, but it teases many more. And I mean, it's like this incredible lake with a reflective surface reflecting these beautiful mountains filled with fall foliage, you know, these browns and reds and oranges and yellows. And there's like a waterfall and trickling water and birds flying by. And it's just all done with pixel art, all done with the most skilled pixel art. Anyway, I've talked more about this game than you need to, because really there's not much to it. It's just sitting out there kind of enjoying the zen-like state of doing something repetitively with a beautiful view. And Cast and Chill delivers that. So if you're into that, even if you're not into it, I recommend downloading the demo if you love pixel art like I do, because it's some of the best I've seen. Okay. Another demo I played is called Jump the Track. This is a bizarre game that's a sort of a storytelling game. It's a comedic storytelling about a guy who's, you know, trying to beat this casino. And the art style is very odd and offbeat, a very two-dimensional cell art looking, and big characters that have big dialogue scenes. And everything you do in the game, every dialogue moment, every decision moment, comes down to playing pachinko, which is a twist.
Or Peggle for, you know, it's very much Peggle adjacent, right? Which is also
pachinko,
Peggle, the video game. Yeah.
But Peggle as the means of deciding your fate. It's Peggle as... It's not like the guy in the game is going to play the pachinko machine. He is in a dialogue scene, and it's like, how's this dialogue going to go? What are you going to be able to say? How are you going to get yourself out of this one? Pachinko, or, you know, Peggle comes up, and you Peggle your way through the, you know, you drop the ball and it bounces around and it gets, you know, a score. And at a certain score threshold, your dialogue options unlock. Cool. It's cool. It did not grab me because I wasn't taken with the art style or the writing, but I think for others it might be. And if you like Peggle, I think it's a cool mashup of you know, that kind of game, which I inherently really do like. I love Peggles, and I love more casual games like that, but like applied to this kind of larger narrative. Pretty cool. Again, that's called Jump the Track. A game, Christian, I think you would really like is called Oscuro Blossoms Glow. This is a 2D sort of platform puzzler with really, really beautiful aesthetic. It's almost got this kind of like Dig Dug thing going on, where you're going above the ground and below the ground, and only the areas that you are spelunking open up. So there's like large patches of black on the screen with like a little tunnel, you know, cut out from it. But the tunnels are bright and colorful and beautiful. Really lovely game. And most of the demo involves creating pathways for yourself by making plants grow. And the way you do that is transporting their glow from point to point. So you can like extract a glow from a plant and move it over to another plant and inject the glow into that plant, which makes it, you know, grow. I said glow and grow are a little too close. It may be confusing, but the glow makes it grow. So you can, you know, create vines that you can climb on, push things out of the way. It's a little puzzle solving, but there's some platforming in it. I think you would dig it, Christian. It's a really pretty game. It's called Oscuro Blossoms Glow. All right. Next up is a game called Rue Valley. This has very distinct influences from, oh, why did I just blank on the name of the game? Disco Elysium. Hotel. It's okay. Disco Elysium adjacent. In that it is a, you know, isometric kind of point and click adventure, but it's all about the inner life of the character. And you play a character that you build at the beginning by putting points in their personality. And there's no way to put points into personality that don't have bad effects. Like, it's, you build a personality that's just inherently flawed. And it's like, how much anxiety do you have? Or if you don't have anxiety, you're full of yourself and arrogant. Or, you know, so you're balancing these three prongs of personality, but both sides of the scale are problematic in a certain way. You know, they're going to give you difficulties that you're going to have to deal with. So you know, you're playing as this person who has all these, you know, psychological challenges, and where you put those points will open up certain options. And then it's a roguelike or a sort of time loop game where you're playing the same period of time over and over. You're learning more about the characters, and your psyche is being affected by the previous runs. So you're not really healing yourself, but you're sort of expanding your various issues into different areas. And that allows you to handle the situations in different ways. I think the writing is very strong in Rue Valley, at least the small demo that I played. And I think the art is truly exceptional in this one. A really beautiful game. It's got this kind of sketchbook look to the characters, but then the environments are very detailed and sort of stark. Really, really beautiful game. Rue Valley, if you're into Disco Elysium and its offshoots, I think this is one to keep an eye on. The one that was a big standout for me from the 6-1 Indie Showcase is a game called Future Vibe Check. This is described as an automation game and a rhythm game mashed up. So if you've played games like, what is it called? Machinarium? There's a bunch of automation games. What's that guy's name? Zach something or other. The automation games where you Factorium and all those, Factorio, I think it's called. Anyway, there's a lot of them. I messed up many of their names. But I've sort of appreciate them from afar. I've gotten into a few of them very peripherally. I haven't really gotten super into a automation game, but I appreciate them. I love watching videos of them or screenshots of the levels of crazy complexity that people can get with these kinds of games. But this one intrigued me because not only are you creating a beautiful assembly line that operates and creates this, you know, increasingly crazy level of complexity, but as you're doing that, you're creating music. So that's the idea of Future Vibe Check. The demo is very much a automation game. It is more automation game than it is rhythm game, although everything you do sort of has a facet of rhythm to it. So you have to like mine resources. And the way you do that is by hitting the button rhythmically to do it. But then you're building nodes, you're connecting things, and the building blocks are musical instrument pieces. And so you ultimately end up making this very complex thing that also sounds cool. So I'm really into it. The vibe check of the Future Vibe Check is a sort of narrative layer that I didn't love. It's got a very, very specific vibe is the right word, I guess. A very specific aesthetic to it. It's very stylized, and everything is about, you know, the vibe of the music, and it's all described to you in this very stylized language. And I think it obscures the game in a way that is fun potentially, but for me it felt a little unnecessary and complicated it in a way that I didn't feel fun. Anyway, if you can get over that, I do think this game is pretty incredible. And I like the way it looks, and the stuff that you end up making is really cool. It's neat how no matter how I build my little factory, cool music comes from it. Like you can't make something bad musically. It does that magic video game thing where it makes anything you do sort of work. And I think that's pretty cool. All right. I've left my favorite for last, and that is a game called Artists Impact. Artists Impact, A-R-T-I-S, Impact. This is a game I was definitely not sure about when I downloaded the demo. I thought the little video they showed looked interesting, but this demo got its hooks in me, and I really think this game could be cool. This is a pixel art role-playing game where you play as a woman in this futuristic world that has AI and bots and constructs and stuff, but is sort of hired by this company to do these missions. You have a samurai sword and you do full-on RPG turn-based combat where, you know, like JRPG style, you've got, you know, basic attack, you've got skills, you've got magic abilities, you've got items. But none of that really explains what makes this game special, which is it's like playing a manga. It's like, it's got so much style to it. You are playing inside sort of nested windows. So it uses like only a small percentage of the screen real estate at any given time, but then it'll like layer on an external window, almost like a panel in a comic book or a manga. But then it'll like, it won't do it like a comic book does it. Like it'll add a panel and then like zoom in and have a panel within that panel and have a panel within that panel that zooms in farther, or it'll like shoot out something like a pop-out window on your desktop to show you something. And then other times it'll get to a cutscene that uses just a completely different art style where it'll just like all of a sudden be black and white and like a sketch pad and characters drawn completely differently. And it does that so many times in so many different ways. It's really clever. The writing I think is strong. The world is fascinating. It is a game that is, not out yet. The demo is pre-release. The demo says the game is going to be much harder than the demo is. So I think there's going to be an element of like, can you survive this game? And already in the demo, there's a number of enemies that you can just wander into that will one-shot you and there's nothing you can do about it. Not something I love, especially in that genre where it's like, this isn't a Souls game. This isn't like, oh, your skill can beat it. It's like, no, it's turn-based. I push attack. My attack does zero. Its attack does a billion D. That's not fun. But it's just like, oh, don't attack that guy yet, I guess. All that said, go ahead.
Its description on Steam right now is a fun turn-based RPG set in a future world of humans and AI. Play as a Kane to explore vibrant locations, battle with simple yet fluid combat, enjoy side quests full of charming surprises. With a playful, humorous style and clever details, this adventure is light, easy, and full of smiles. Is that part of the bit? Is that part of the AI?
Because it literally says, hey, don't get used to this demo because the full game is going to be way harder than this. It says that, like when you play it.
So wild. I don't know,
maybe it's messing with me. And there was a number of, you can like wander the wrong direction and there's a boss and it's like, you want to fight this boss battle? And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. And it's like one shot at you. And it's like, oh. And then it's always telling you like, hey, if you don't save, you're going to lose everything. So I don't know if it's part of the bit, but it didn't feel like part of a bit. But the writing is really strong. It kind of has a lot to do with sexism and everybody underestimating this character because she like every guy character she interacts with is hitting on her and she's over it. But it's I think smartly done. The narrative is really well crafted in that it is taking you from place to place, having these interactions like through this sort of mixed media presentation style. I just was really blown away by how clever and different it is than anything else I've really played. It really feels like it has its own identity that is so fresh and so interesting. And then the game itself was really fun. Beautiful looking in all its various facets. This was the demo that I came away with most impressed with. Artis Impact. All right. That's my playlist. We have a little bit of time for some tabletop time. And I know Mike is here. He always has a great bunch of tabletop games he's been playing. So let's jump into it. But first, we're going to take our last break for a sponsor. We'll be right back with some tabletop time right after this. All right, let's do it. Right now. Mike, I love having you on because we get to talk board games. Have you been bringing to the table lately?
Oh, well, I went to PAX East and
awesome.
We went YOLO because of the tariffs, so we bought a ton of games. The one I want to start with, there's an interesting story behind it. There's an interesting legal story behind it where the guy's second game got stolen. Like, there's this whole thing.
Wow.
That's a totally different story. But I want to talk about Brother Ming Games and a game that was Kickstarted. It's available now called React. And it is effectively, and this is what attracted me to the game. You play, it's a 1v1 game. You play as an incarnation or an avatar of an art form. So there's a calligrapher, a sculptor, a tattoo artist, and they all have very different mechanics. It's very asymmetric. And when I demoed it, I was playing as the dancer, who has a way of doing damage differently than the calligrapher who I was playing against. It's just a gorgeous game. Check it out. It's on Board Game Geek. You can learn about it. And then Brother Ming's second game is really another asymmetrical game. This one's like a fight. It's kind of in the vein of a fighting game. And the board is like an arcade cabinet, and there are these large marbles. And the way you do moves is by pulling marbles out of the thing. It's really cool. Check out both these games. It's React is the one that's out, and Rematch is the one that's coming to Kickstarter, I think, later this year.
Amazing.
So yeah, that was a great one from PAX East. Also stopped by the Overpower booth. If you are a collectible card game fan, you might recognize that name. It was a game that had both Marvel and DC licenses back in the late 90s, early aughts, and then it went away. So this new company called Lazarus Rising Games brought it back. They have the first set, which is enormous, hit Kickstarter. It's all public domain characters. So it's Robin Hood and the Sheriff of Nottingham and Greek gods and a bunch of Edgar Rice Burroughs characters. So all public domain stuff. But it plays really interestingly. And as much as I love a lot of CCGs, I just don't have time for them. But one of the things I really liked about it is the booster distribution. Because of the way the game works, you have characters and they have cards that are dedicated to those characters. Instead of spreading all those cards out through different boosters, when you open a booster, you get two characters and five of their six ability cards right there. So it's an easy game that you can draft. Just open up all your boosters, put all the characters out, take turns picking. Boom, you're done.
That's cool.
Really, really good. It's a very different take on CCGs, and it plays very differently than something like Magic.
That's called Overpower?
Overpower. Yep.
Awesome.
Cool. Should be in stores soon because I think they're delivering the Kickstarter stuff right now.
All right.
Another one from PAX East, Token Terror's Battlegrounds. This is like the way I would describe this is asymmetrical fantasy chess. Quite like Archon for us olds.
Yeah.
But you've got two factions. Every faction has two abilities. You move one unit on your turn. You get three actions. There's some other stuff, but it's one of those games that has a very low skill floor and a really high skill ceiling, which really appeals to me because you can introduce it to pretty much anybody and walk them through and they'll get the basics. And then over time, you kind of learn the deeper stuff.
Awesome. Token Terror's Battlegrounds. I like the title.
Yes. Cool. And it's a really cool little game. And the last one is one of the Button Shy. I don't know if you're familiar with Button Shy. They make these wallet games.
Yeah.
This one's called Apropos of Movies. It's a great game to play in lines, to play at dinner. And you just put a card down and it will have a descriptor of a movie, like must have a pet. So you pick a movie that has a pet in it. Yeah. And then the next one, you pull a card and you have to play it in a way that the last movie didn't have it. So it could be takes place in space. Or if you named a movie with a pet in space, it would be doesn't take place in space. So you have to get a new movie. And by the end, you're going through 4, 5, 6 cards like that. It's really hard to think of movies that fit this very narrow, weird description.
Love that.
But it's a cooperative game. It's really, really casual. But I love those button shy games because you can just throw them in your pocket when you're out and about or you're traveling. I throw a few of them in my backpack. There's a Walking Dead one that's really good.
Amazing.
The button shy games. Check them out. They're $12 games.
Apropos of Movies. I'm buying that as soon as I can. That sounds perfect for, you know, bringing to a party. Hanging out with friends. Love it. Very cool. Love that you brought those. No, I hadn't heard of any of them. Very cool stuff.
Awesome.
I'll throw out one game that have been playing a bit with my family. My son's been really digging it. It's called Dragon Keepers. All one word. Not to be confused with Dragon Keepers, which is a different board game with two words. Dragon Keepers. This is a relatively recent game. I think it came out in 2024, if I recall correctly. It's a clever little card game where...
That's 2024, all one word. Not 2024. It's 2024.
That's right.
Is when it came out. Yeah.
It's a set collection game. You're collecting sets of colored dragons. But the twist here is that the back of every dragon card, so you have, you know, dragons of different color that you're collecting in your hand, but the back of every card is also used in the game. And you create what it, really cool aesthetically. If you put, there's certain cards that are the left-hand side of an open book and other cards that are the right-hand side of an open book, and you place those two decks together and it creates a visual of an open book. And the left-hand side of the open book tells you how many dragons we are looking for at this time. The set you can create, so 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 cards. And the right-hand side says which color. So at any given time, you are only able to play the designated set that is available at that time. But as you're collecting cards and you have those colored dragons in your hand, you can also play the back of them onto the book to change the set we're looking for right now. So it's really, a fun push and pull of like, ooh, I got 4 red dragons, but we're not looking for red dragons and we're not looking for 4 of them. And the back of the red dragon says 4. So I could play that, but now I only have 3, so it's a wonderful push and pull. And it has some a few little fiddly rules that make it a little more complicated than that, which is can trip some, I think, age groups up, because I'm playing this with younger kids, can trip up some age groups because the scoring can be a little complicated. Like there's a lot of different ways you keep track of score, and you're constructing these discs out of components. You think maybe, I don't know, Trivial Pursuit, like your components of a disc, and you're encircling an egg that then you flip over and you find out how many points that was. A lot of fiddliness to the scoring, which is a bit of a bummer because it adds complexity to how you teach it. And another fiddly rule is as you place sets down, let's say I do white dragons and red dragons, and now I have 2 sets of dragons. I can keep adding more sets of those colored dragons, but as soon as I bookend one of those colors, so if I'm down playing blue dragons and I've bookended my white dragons, I can no longer play additional sets of white dragons. So you're like limiting yourself by, diversifying your number of stacks in front of you. But also there's incentives point-wise to being the first to get to 4 different dragon colors and stuff like that. So there's a lot of fiddly point scoring rules that can be a bit much to grok as a young person, but I'm playing with an 8-year-old and he really likes the game. I think the art is fabulous. And, you know, once you've kind of played it once or twice, those rules aren't as intimidating anymore. So Dragon Keepers is one I really recommend for families. And you can play with young kids. It's a really cool introduction to set collection. The theme is cool. The components are cool. And I think the mechanics are really neat. And the idea of multi-use for your cards and the aesthetic of creating that book and having that book apply to all the players at once. And we can all affect it in certain ways. It's a good game. So there you go. That's my tabletop time. It's Dragon Keepers. And that's going to do it for this episode of DLC. We do have parting gifts coming up, so stick around for those. But Mike Futter, it's always so much fun talking to you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me again. I really, really appreciate it. I love talking with you guys.
Tell folks where they can keep up with you and all the cool stuff you do online.
Sure. I'm over on Blue Sky now, footerish.bsky.social. And of course, the Virtual Economy Podcast, virtualeconcast.com. We're on all the major podcast distribution platforms. And let's see, we have a Blue Sky also, virtualeconomy.bsky.social.
Have I been mispronouncing it? Is it footer, not futter?
So technically it's footer.
I apologize.
It's one of those things where no. It got completely changed on Ellis Island. And
okay.
I don't know if I told you this story, but when I was in junior high school, I went and played trumpet at a friend's church for Christmas Eve. And they had me in the program as Michael Fatter. So pretty much as long as we're not Michael Fatter, I'm good.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, I strive to be accurate and I didn't mean to assume.
It's all good.
Very cool. Christian Spicer, what do you got going on this week?
Well, I just wanted to say we actually call it No Thank You Island now is what we call it. You show up and we're like, no, thank you.
Yeah.
Island. It's
I didn't order this.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can get the merch for it. It's huge. It's huge. My plan, and I hopefully have this turned around by the time you're listening to this, is the season finale of Last of Us Season 2 has happened. I want to get some thoughts out on that. And I will do so via my Substack, which is christianspicer.substack.com. I usually write conversational topics about video games, but I got to join Dave and Patrick for their Decoding TV when The Last of Us Season 2 started. And they're doing excellent work over there. So if you want to keep listening to that and watching their stuff, please do. But I want to write some thoughts about how this season wrapped up, which will probably just lead with the hardest part for me, Jeff, is calling this The Last of Us Season 2 when it's clearly The Last of Us Part 2. Like, it's so, I know it's a tiny thing, but every time I open up my Mac, soon to be HBO Max app, and I'm like, Last of Us, I've already watched that. Oh, that's right. It's just Season 2. They don't change the name of the show the way they do video games. But I have some thoughts. I will be
going to get even weirder when Season 3 is still Part 2.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and Season 4 is also still Part 2.
Yeah.
And then I'm on Blue Sky, and so is the show. The show is DLC Hype Train, and you can find me there, Christian Spicer.
I'm also on Blue Sky. I'm at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. We do other podcasts, including the Filmcast, which is talking about movies and TV shows. I also do We Have Concerns, a comedy science show you can find. And I'm raising money for Providence Cancer Institute by running a whole long, long way at the end of August. You can help me raise money for a very good cause by going to runjeffrun.com. All right. Let's wrap things up with our parting gifts. Hey, give us a suggestion. Mike, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
Oh, yeah. Star Wars Tales in the Underworld. 100%. I've only watched the first episode, but I'm a huge Asajj Ventress fan, and it started off huge, and I'm very, very excited to watch the rest.
Awesome. This is that new animated Star Wars show on Disney Plus, right?
Yes.
Very cool. Very cool. Check it out. Star Wars Tales of the Underworld. Christian Spicer, what is your parting gift?
Speaking of movies, Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. I think you and I might have a little different final opinion on this, Jeff. I loved this movie. Does it make total sense? No.
Does it make any sense?
Did I text you like, why is this character in this position in this movie? Never explained. Never explained. But Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning is the most third-person action video game movie not based on a video game I've ever seen. Like, everything about The Final Reckoning is just the third-person action video games I love. Like, each set piece, every time the cast comes out, they all hero pose. Like, they're walking in a line, and then they fan out and all hit their light, and then they're on to the next set piece. Like, it feels like an Uncharted, a Tomb Raider, a Gears of War in some moments. Like, it is just this video game third-person set piece spectacle. And that was all I needed to carry me through. Once that clicked, like, oh, this is just setting me up for the next. The plane's going to crash. They're going to jump out of it. And then they're going to land on dirt bikes. And then they're going to jump out of it. And then they're going to land in a car and jump out of it. Then they're going to land in something else and jump out of it. Then they're going to go underwater and jump out of it. I was on board start to finish. I thought it was incredible. And I have a feeling it is not The Final Reckoning, despite what they want us to believe.
One more reckoning.
Yeah, yet another reckoning.
My parting gift is a new two-part documentary about Pee-wee Herman entitled Pee-wee as Himself. Well, I guess it's more about Paul Reubens than it is Pee-wee Herman. But as the documentary makes very clear, those two personas are hard to extrapolate at sometimes. And man, what a fascinating human being he was. So much as somebody that grew up, you know, in the 80s, you know, Pee-wee was a phenomenon and inescapable and just part of the culture. And the fact that this man basically convinced everyone that Pee-wee was a real person, and then we all sort of were jarred by realizing, oh no, Paul Reubens is a real person, and got arrested twice. Is a wild thing. It's a wild, wild thing. And I think this is a insightful thing. You know, Paul Reubens passed away and was concealing a cancer diagnosis for the longest time. And most of this documentary was made without the filmmakers knowing that he was sick, even though they were interviewing him for 40 hours. It's a wild thing, the levels of performance art, of deception, of commitment to the bit, of living closeted and uncloseted. It's wild, his life, and it's powerful and interesting. It's available on HBO Max, the one to watch for HBO. I highly recommend it. I could not stop watching. It's two long episodes. I think both of them are 90 minutes plus. Well worth it. Enlightening and very, very interesting, especially if you are a person that grew up with Pee-wee. Mm-hmm. All right. We also got a listener-suggested parting gift. This comes to us at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. It comes from Phil from Cincinnati. Excuse me, Philip. Philip's from Cincinnati. Philip says, I have a new favorite band, and I wanted to share it with the DLC community. They're called RC Drive, A-R-C-Y, RC Drive. Or Archie Drive? I guess it's RC Drive. And just released their first full-length album called The Pit. In my opinion, this is a nostalgic masterpiece from beginning to end, inspired by grunge and rock bands of the 90s with a modern pop twist. This band is definitely on my watch list for amazing things to come. They also have some great acoustic versions of their songs on YouTube. I highly encourage you to have a listen. Thanks for the great podcast and positive vibes. Sincerely, Philip from Cincinnati. Thank you, Philip. RC Drive, check them out. If you'd like to have your parting gift read on our show, send it to us, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of DLC. Thanks again to Mike Footer and Christian Spicer for hanging out with me. Thanks to our musical contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star for those cool bumpers. Our theme song was composed by White Cube, which is Jason Sherry and T. Ryan Arnold. You can get merch for our show by visiting our store, store.dlcpod.com. Also, our biggest thanks are always reserved for our patrons. Thank you, patrons. Without you, we would not be here. You can become a patron at patreon.com/DLCpod. We will be back next week. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.